This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, a tug of war between the Obama and Romney campaigns over Chrysler and the future of Jeep.
Both campaigns have sometimes played fast and loose with the truth and have glossed over some of the facts.
Plus, what's wrong with the way we're choosing who sits on Michigan's Supreme Court?
I think that we would all be better served if we could get the most important court out of the partisan system.
A conversation with Supreme Court candidate Judge Sheila Johnson. And scientists meet today to look at climate change in Michigan.
We can say the region is getting warmer. It's hard to say exactly in your backyard what that's going to mean.
Plus, encouraging signs of health on the Detroit auto front. Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, all through campaign 2012, we've been seeing direct appeals to certain blocks of voters. You know, the so-called soccer mom vote or the Hispanic vote. But there are two large blocks of voters, especially here in Michigan, who seem to have been overlooked by the presidential candidates, Arab American and Muslim American voters. We'll take a look at why that is coming up on Stateside. But first, Ford and Chrysler released their third quarter earnings today, both automakers posting strong third quarter numbers based almost entirely on profits in North America. Here to take a closer look at the numbers and what they mean is Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's Autobeat reporter. Hey, Tracy, give us the rundown. Are they smiling at Ford and Chrysler?
Especially at Ford. You know, if you look at North America, their profits are really strong. They had their best quarterly profits since at least 2000, made $2.2 billion here in North America. Chrysler made $381 million here. Then you turn your attention to Europe, and things do not look so good.
Okay.
So, you know, people just aren't buying cars there because of this very deep recession, and it's expected to last several years, that recession. So Ford lost $468 million there, and Fiat, Chrysler's majority owner, lost $364 million.
That is a big ouch. So what could the auto companies do to kind of face this poor economy in Europe?
Well, Ford has announced a turnaround plan last week. It's very similar to what they did here in the U.S., where they downsized to the demand that they had, and then they also at the same time invested heavily in new products. Fiat sort of is doing that. They announced their plan today. They're going to try not to close any plants. They're going to increase production of Alfa Romeo and Maserati cars, not for Europe, because nobody's got any money there.
I was going to say, not for Europe.
And export them. And they're also going to build a small Jeep there. But frankly, the biggest part of their plan is just keep Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep going, make Jeep a global brand. And it's really an interesting twist in this story because Chrysler is saving Fiat. And we thought Fiat was going to come in and save Chrysler.
Yeah, we thought it was going to be the other way around. Meantime, Tracy, yesterday, Consumer Reports was out, and not such great news for Ford. Dropped almost to last place in the reliability survey. What does that all mean at the Glasshouse?
Well, I can tell you Ford executives are very concerned about this. This is a huge fall from grace. 2 years ago, Ford was Detroit's poster child for improvements in quality and reliability. And in this later survey, they are down right next to the last on the list. And some of the issue is Ford's newest vehicles came off the assembly line with more problems than they should have. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is this My Ford Touch infotainment system. And people find it confusing and complex. But Ford keeps putting it on more and more of its vehicles, so you get more and more people complaining, and they have to do something about this or it is going to hurt their sales.
Finally, Tracy, GM's earnings are coming out tomorrow. What do you think we should be looking for?
We're going to see similar results to Ford. Strong results in North America, I suspect. Very poor results in Europe. General Motors is also losing money in that region and has to have a turnaround plan of its own. We just haven't seen it yet, I think. And probably there's the added bonus for General Motors of strong sales in China. GM is neck and neck with Volkswagen in China. And so despite the slowing economy there, we're probably going to see GM still doing very well in China. And I'm going to go out on a limb here in terms of what we will see tomorrow with GM's earnings, no matter what they are. I'm going to make this wild, crazy prediction that they are going to be politicized.
No.
Yeah, I really think so.
You're a very brave woman. Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's auto reporter. Tracy, thanks so much. Well, with the clock ticking down on campaign 2012, the closing messages of the presidential campaigns appear to be zeroing in on Chrysler and what it will or won't be doing to Jeep. Now, here's where it all seemed to start, in Ohio, where Governor Romney was on the campaign trail last weekend.
I saw a story today that one of the great manufacturers in this state, Jeep, now owned by the Italians, is thinking of moving all production to China. I will fight for every good job in America. I'm going to fight to make sure trade is fair, and if it's fair, America will win.
Now, that was followed by a Romney TV commercial repeating that claim, although Chrysler jumped right up to say, not so. Chrysler's statement, quote, Jeep has no intention of shifting production of its Jeep models out of North America to China. And then the Obama campaign wasted a little time unveiling a commercial calling the Romney ad a lie. David Shepherdson's with the Detroit News Washington Bureau and is covering this story for the news. David, how truthful are either of these campaign ads? They're certainly 180 degrees apart.
There's a lot of details you have to really dig into to the messages. Let's go back to Thursday night to the audio clip you played. Clearly, what Governor Romney was saying, he was not accurate. I mean, Chrysler does not have any intention of moving U.S. production to China. But what the company is considering, and what's reflected in the governor's ad, is that they are considering producing Jeeps in China for Chinese consumers, much like General Motors and Ford build Buicks and Fords for Chinese consumers in China.
Yes.
But they're not shipping cars from China to the United States. The reason this ad has gotten so much attention is because Ohio has really may end up being the key swing state. In fact, both Governor Romney and the president have spent more than $170 million on television advertising. And concern on the Obama campaign is that if a few blue-collar voters in auto towns hear this message and opt to vote for Governor Romney, that could tip the balance. So in the radio ad that the governor aired starting Saturday in Toledo, he slightly changed the wording and said now Chrysler is considering building Jeeps in China. And then the next line was, I'll fight for American jobs. Hmm. So the implication that many critics have jumped on was that he was repeating the same claim. The Obama campaign called it a lie. The Romney campaign defends it, saying it's accurate in terms of possible Chinese production for Chinese consumers. But it certainly shows how really the race has gotten so tight in Ohio and tempers are flaring, and you know that's why you're seeing this kind of rhetoric, which the Obama campaign doesn't normally call things the governor has said a lie in advertisement. So it just shows how harsh this campaign is getting toward the end.
And one has to ask how the campaign, the Romney campaign, could justify running an ad that, as you spelled it out, seems to really, really massage the truth. Because it doesn't sound like the fact that Jeep may be building Jeeps in China for Chinese customers is going to cost any jobs here in America.
The argument they could make, and it would be a very small number of jobs, is that currently the U.S., they're exporting those Jeeps to China. It's not a very high number. And that if that export production wasn't in the U.S. and was in China, it could reduce employment. But that's speculative, of course. In fact, Chrysler hasn't even made a final decision whether to build Jeeps in China. But I think this really brings up how both campaigns have sometimes played fast and loose with the truth and have really glossed over some of the facts. And I'll give you one other example. Mm-hmm. The president, a couple of weeks ago, in his Saturday radio address, he said, well, Governor Romney wanted to let Detroit go bankrupt. You know, I would not let Detroit go bankrupt, he basically said. But, of course, in fact, General Motors and Chrysler did file bankruptcy. And in fact, the Obama administration forced the two companies into bankruptcy. Now, it was a different type of bankruptcy, much faster than the type that the governor was envisioning. But they still filed for bankruptcy. And I think both sides are just sometimes willing to push the envelope as much as they can in terms of trying to paint their opponent's position as the wrong one.
And certainly the auto companies right at the beginning just stepped right back, leaped way back. We don't want you in the plants. Yeah. No photo ops. They want nothing to do with playing a role in either side's campaign and being the poster children for damaged goods that have been revived. They want nothing to do with that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. No, you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, these two companies, remember, you know, are still trying to get away from the image of companies that would have failed without the government stepping in. I mean, GM is still ridiculed by many as government motors, since the U.S. still holds a nearly one-third stake in the automaker. And, you know, Chrysler, the government has completely exited and has managed to avoid some of the bad publicity up until now, frankly, that GM has, in part because GM is the largest company and just has tended to attract more attention than Chrysler. But you're absolutely right. These are companies that want to keep their heads down. They want to sell cars. They don't want to get involved in politics or the controversy. And I think they're both really looking forward to Election Day, because, you know, the conventional wisdom is that after the election, people are going to stop debating the auto bailout. By now, it's been 4 years. GM and Chrysler have been out of bankruptcy for more than 3 years. The companies are both making profits. Yes, they're both like Ford. Everybody's having trouble in Europe because Europe's in a recession and people aren't buying cars. But the companies are doing well. They're making money. They're employing people. And I think after the election, I think there'll sort of be an end to the debate of the auto bailout. I mean, a lot of this has been driven by politics and by, you know, Republicans are doing what Democrats would do if they were in their shoes and, you know, trying to push back on, you know, what's been a real success story for the Obama administration.
David Shepherdson, Detroit News, Washington Bureau. Thanks for joining us on Stateside, David.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
And here at Stateside, we want to connect with you always. You can find us online. Go to michiganradio.org. You can go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still ahead, we continue our look at the proposals you'll be finding on next Tuesday's ballot. We'll talk with Michigan Radio's investigative reporter Lester Graham about Proposal 5. That's the one that would require a supermajority of the legislature or a vote of the people to raise taxes. We'll have that story in 10 minutes for you here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're continuing our conversations with the candidates for Michigan Supreme Court. Joined now by candidate Sheila Johnson, who's currently a judge with the 46th District Court serving the city of Southfield. She has been on the bench for 10 years, and she was the first African-American ever to be elected in that jurisdiction. Judge, welcome to Stateside. Start out, if you will, by telling us, what is your personal view of the role of a state Supreme Court justice?
Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you and your listeners.
Tell us, what is your personal view of the role of a state Supreme Court justice?
Well, there's several roles. The role that most people know is that, you know, the court is the final arbiter of all of the way the law is applied in the state of Michigan. So those decisions are generally final decisions on the way the law is and how it evolves and how it should be applied. And so that those decisions trickle down to all of the lower courts, which must follow. And so primarily most people think of the Supreme Court justices of ruling on cases, reviewing cases that have come from lower courts, and then making sure that justice is fairly applied and that the law has evolved in the way that it should be evolved and that it's followed in the way that it's written. But the Supreme Court also has an administrative function. And so the court really governs all of the lower courts. It's in charge of making sure that cases are processed in a fair and orderly manner. And certainly it has a lot to do with the access to justice for everyone, because they really are oversee the implementation of the Michigan court rules And so we have a unique opportunity as justices to touch people's access to justice on many levels, including making sure that the rules that we go by are easily understandable and accessible to not just the lawyers, but to the regular common people who may not have legal representation. Mm-hmm. So it's a really big job.
What role do you think that the judiciary should play in political issues in Michigan?
Well, technically none. The judiciary is supposed to be that one branch of government that's supposed to be above any politicalization involved in cases. We're simply supposed to apply the law that the legislators wrote and to analyze and develop the common law and try to apply it as it has developed over the years. And it's unfortunate that the way we select our Supreme Court justices has really put a little bit of a blemish on that unbiased nature and the separation from what people expect between the branches of government.
And by that, you mean the fact you have to raise money to run and be backed by a party?
And backed by a political party. Mm-hmm. And it really gives the appearance that there's an impropriety, that the decisions of the justices are going to be affected by the special interests that support those candidates and by the special interests that are connected with the parties that nominate the judges. And it's really unfortunate when we've seen, historically, lawyers and commentators view the current Supreme Court as being biased and more one-sided in their decisions, more towards corporate interests rather than towards the center, dealing justice, you know, in a fair and equitable manner for regular, ordinary people across the board. And it's very unfortunate that we have such a reputation, simply probably because of the associations for the political parties that nominate the justices in the first place.
What would you like to see the system be?
Well, unfortunately, we do have to live within the confines of the system that we have, and it's not much that the courts or the judges can do to change it. It's really a legislative function, and the legislature has put the nomination of our justices in this partisan system because I guess that's what they knew best. But what I would like to see is it removed totally from that system. I still believe in the people's right to elect anyone who represents them, including the judiciary. But I think that it would be well suited to have it in a truly nonpartisan manner and not in the manner that we choose now, where it's nominated by political party, funded mostly by political parties, and then placed on the nonpartisan ballot so that people really don't have the transparency to even understand the philosophical basis for which of these judges subscribe to. They have no information. So I would just hope that we could put it back into the total nonpartisan system where our local judges are elected, where they fund their own campaigns. There's really no special interest involved, so to speak. They plead their case to the public and then let the public still choose. I think that we would all be better served if we could get the most important court out of the partisan system.
Judge Johnson, what is your view of future Supreme Courts overruling past high court decisions?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of that historically commentators have said have occurred with our current Supreme Court. And I really don't think that we should be in the business of, once we get elected, overruling precedent immediately. I don't think that really does interfere with the predictability and the stability of the law, which is what stare decisis and that term means, of following the law as it evolved and not changing it just because you don't like the decision or you have a different philosophy, and even not changing it if it was wrongly decided. I think that we have to step higher and look at a higher standard when we're going to make some changes. And I think that's the problem with our current court, is that case law that's been standard case law for years is suddenly overturned without any predictable reason for doing it. And usually it's a largely unexplained departure. So I think if we're going to make a change to the system, we should be careful. Standards that I would probably look at if we were having to make a change would be to make sure to see whether or not this rule would be intolerable anymore because it just defies practical workability. I think if we have to look at such that whether or not it would cause a hardship or an inequity by relying on the rule, whether or not if we uphold it, it would be a serious detriment and prejudicial to our public interest somehow. And again, whether or not it was really an abrupt, unexplained departure from precedent that really had no real basis, such as a constitutional basis. But I totally disagree with just overruling cases because we don't like them or simply because we think that they're wrongly decided.
And finally, John Johnson, let's get past the election, look ahead. What do you see as the biggest challenge the Michigan Supreme Court faces?
Well, budget issues are always an issue now. You know, every court has had to streamline services, and the Supreme Court is overseeing the numerous courts across our state. As resources are more limited, we still have to deliver justice fairly and swiftly in the face of these diminishing resources. So I think that as far as budget concerns, that's going to be an issue we're going to have to continue to address. We're going to have to implement, you know, cost-saving collaboration, perhaps have more concurrent jurisdiction plans among different courts that have different various jurisdictions so that one or two judges can, you know, oversee a variety of types of things and therefore cut down on the need to have a number of judges in a particular area. I think we're going to have to see some courts and judges cut. I think that we can also reserve some costs by implementing better technology. We need to move more into the 21st century here and get more statewide technological advances put in place where we can all see what's going on in courts. Courts can have access to what's going on at the north and the south end, and so that would facilitate these concurrent plans easily. And, of course, we can make things easier for our citizens by having more cost-saving measures such as online filing, the online payment of bills, and hopefully people will be easier. It'll be easier to pay for tickets and increase revenues that way and decrease the number of people needed to process these kind of payments. But there are a lot of things that I think that we'll probably be facing, such as making changes to the indigent defense system. It doesn't serve people well when they don't have adequate counsel who are adequately prepared and trained. So there are a number of issues that I see down the road that we as Supreme Court justices will have a significant impact on as we guide our court system into the future.
Judge Sheila Johnson, candidate for the Michigan Supreme Court, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And now we move to the proposals that Michigan voters will see on the ballot 1 week from today. Lester Graham with Michigan Radio's investigative unit Michigan Watch joins us now to take a closer look at Proposal 5, the so-called two-thirds proposal. Lester, explain to us how Proposal 5 could change the tax picture in Michigan if it's passed.
Well, right now we can have a tax increase with a simple majority of the legislature and the governor signing it. This would change that, saying entering into the Constitution, it must be a two-thirds supermajority or a vote of the people before there can be any tax increase.
All right. So it seems that we can't get our lawmakers even to agree on getting a budget done in time. We've seen standoffs. So is there any stretch of the imagination where backers feel they're going to be able to get the legislature to agree?
I have seen some reports that indicate that Michigan has never in the history of the state passed a tax increase by a two-thirds majority.
So the upshot could be what if this is passed?
Well, it means gridlock by some accounts. Basically, what it does, anytime you change the tax structure, there's a little bit of tax cut here. There's a little bit of tax increase here. There's some loopholes closed over here. The idea is to make sure that you have the lowest tax possible spread across as broadly, as widely as possible.
Okay.
So if you can't have a little tax cut here and a little tax increase there without a two-thirds majority vote, then you've really limited. The recent tax restructuring we saw, which some people are not a fan of, would not have happened. But then Prop A, which a lot of people say, hey, that really lowered my real estate taxes, wouldn't have happened. There's just no way to really function very well for the legislature to deal with tax structure changes.
Where did this come from? Who originated this, and what's the genesis?
Well, the group is called the Michigan Alliance for Prosperity. Basically, it's a few Tea Party members, not all Tea Party members, but the backing, the financial backing, comes from the Maroon family. They are the owners of the Ambassador Bridge.
This does seem to be the election of the Maroons this year, doesn't it?
They have two amendments to the Constitution on the ballot. It's amazing, and they've spent a lot of money to promote certainly Proposal 6, but they've also put a couple of million dollars, actually more than that, into Proposal 5.
If this seems to be something that would cause such gridlock, have we heard enough hue and cry on the other side?
Well, I'll talk about the opposition just for a second, but I want to say it's not, you know, there's one longtime Michigan politician who has been in favor of this idea of a two-thirds majority, Mike Bouchard, who's the sheriff of Oakland County. He's been in favor of this since he was a senator, a state senator back in the 1990s. So this is not just a Tea Party movement. This is a real fiscal conservatives who like the idea. But the opposition basically says this doesn't just make a two-thirds majority. This basically lets 13 senators in the Senate control everything that has to do with tax increases, because you might have the House might pass this unanimously.
Right.
And it goes to the Senate, and right there, 13 senators can stop this from happening. And as Mitch Bean, the former director of the House Fiscal Agency, says, you can always buy 13 senators. Now, I don't mean illegally.
Right.
I just mean with contributions.
And talk about the states that where this has come into play, where they do have a legislative supermajority.
Right. California is the first on the list. But California has a lot more problems than just a two-thirds majority, because they have to have two-thirds majority for passing the budget. There are all kinds of proposals that have been added to their constitution that really make it difficult for legislators there to pass any kind of financial manipulation or financial machination, in that state. So it's really tough for California. There are other states that have a two-thirds majority, but they find that while, you know, they like the idea there are no tax increases, it really does limit what government can do. And that's key, because economies change. Economies evolve. We are not the state we were 30 years ago or 20 years ago. The economy has changed.
Clearly.
The tax structure has to, most economists will say, has to change and evolve with the economy. Otherwise, we're stuck in some kind of mode from 30 years ago. Of course, the answer the Prop 5 supporters say is, well, give to a vote of the people. But I think we've seen this year how easy, if you want to put the money into it, it is to manipulate the voters.
Spend a lot of money, deep pockets, and people are getting information from those TV commercials.
TV ads, yep.
What have we seen ad-wise for Prop 5?
We haven't seen
a lot. Right?
Yeah. In fact, I'm working with the Truth Squad right now to look at some of the ads that have been on. But frankly, most of the money that's gone into ads are from outside the state. The Koch brothers are going to put some money into supporting Prop 5. Grover Norquist from the anti-tax group in Washington is going to be putting some money in, I understand. The really interesting part of this is when you look for supporters of Prop 5, there's the National Federation of Independent Business, these Tea Party groups, and then a lot of out-state folks. When you look who's against Proposal 5, it's nearly everybody else, whether it's business, labor, nonprofits. Any organization you want to look at in this state is saying this is not a good idea. This is going to cause a problem for Michigan. The supporters disagree.
I would suspect the local bodies of government would just be terrified that if you can't get that, money has to come from somewhere. So if you can't get the taxes at the state level because of this legislative supermajority, guess where it's going to roll downhill to?
Yeah, that's a concern the Michigan Chamber of Commerce has mentioned, and the Michigan Municipal League, of course, is really worried about. If you can't get the support you need at the state level, because there's revenue sharing between the state and the local governments, the local governments are going to be on their own, and they're going to have to say, okay, well, we didn't want to do this, but we're going to have to put a tax increase on the ballot here in the local area. So, you know, if you're a business person or just a homeowner, you've got to worry about the tax burden being shifted from the state level to the local level, which kind of got us into trouble once before in Michigan.
Would Prop 5, that passing, how would that impact Michigan's credit rating, do you think?
That's a real concern. In fact, several of the proposals could impact Michigan's tax credit rating. I asked Budget Director John Nixon about that. He kind of wanted to poo-poo it because he was hoping for a really good credit rating. In fact, an improvement in the credit scores for the state of Michigan, and we didn't get one. They're still waiting to see what happens with these proposals, and of course, chief among them is this Proposal 5. Now, why is that important, the credit rating of the state?
Yeah.
It's because the debt we have, and we do have debt as a state for bonds, for long-term infrastructure projects, that could increase the interest rate, which means more of our tax dollars are going to pay higher interest rates than instead of being used for projects that we need done right now.
We talked about California as a kind of a poster child for how it is not working so well, but you say many different circumstances in Michigan. Are there any states where having this legislative supermajority could be said to be working the way it's supposed to or the way its backers claim it will?
Yeah, that's what I was getting to. If you don't like the idea of your taxes ever being increased again at the state level, I guess you could say it works. But as I mentioned before, when you need the flexibility to change your tax structure as your economy changes, those states are getting in trouble. Nevada has it, and I believe their unemployment rate is among the highest in the state. Mississippi has it. Mm-hmm. It's among one of the poorest states in the state or in the country. So, you know, it's a concern. I'm sure that the supporters would point to states where it seems to have worked better. But it's always in combination with your other proposals or your other amendments to your constitution and how your state works. So it's hard to compare. It's apples and oranges most of the time.
And just to recap, so when we walk into a vote next Tuesday, just make sure everybody's clear on the language of this and what a yes vote means.
A yes vote means you are in favor of 2/3 majority or a vote of the people for any tax increase at the state level. A no vote means you want the government to have the flexibility to continue to make tax restructuring as it feels is most beneficial to the economy.
Michigan Radio's Lester Graham, thanks for the look at Proposal 5.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, scientists are meeting today to share their latest research on climate change here in the Great Lakes. We'll find out what they're learning coming up in about 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All through the campaign of 2012, we've seen both President Obama and Governor Romney making direct appeals to certain blocks of voters, women, Hispanics, African Americans, and more. But there appear to be two large blocks of voters, especially here in Michigan, who seem to be overlooked, Arab American and Muslim American voters. Nadia Tanova is with the National Network for Arab American Communities, and Dawood Walid is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations. I want to start with you, Nadia. Do you think that Arab American voters are getting a cold shoulder from the candidates in this race?
I think that there hasn't been as much attention paid to Arab Americans in this race, but I definitely think that, you know, a lot of the issues that Arab Americans care about have been addressed, things like the economy, education, healthcare. So in that regard, some of our issues have been addressed, but we haven't received the individual attention that a lot of other minority groups have received.
And why do you think this is?
I think that, unfortunately, our community is sometimes overlooked. We, you know, we do have a smaller population on whole when you're looking at communities such as Latino community or African American community, so that could be part of the problem. But certainly we know that Arab Americans are still a very influential voting bloc, especially in some key states, Michigan, Florida, Ohio. And so they're definitely important, and we're glad to make sure that the community is out there and making their voice heard at the polls.
And Dawood, your thoughts?
Our community really hasn't been courted by either candidate, but I would also like to point out that American Muslims make up approximately 2% of the American population, which is the same population of the Jewish population in these United States of America. And
so it sounds like you're trying to fight to get a place at the table.
Yeah, I think that we're making headway every year, especially in the great state of Michigan. We have more people who are getting involved as like precinct captains, actually running for office as city councils, for state representatives, for even for congressmen. We have Sayed Taj, who is a doctor from Indian descent, who is running for Congress and running for Thaddeus McCotter's old seat. So mm-hmm. we're becoming more engaged, and we're being more a part of the political process, irrespective of the Democratic or Republican Party not showing us the attention that we feel that we deserve.
Nadia, have you had conversations with the candidates?
Well, the National Network for Arab American Communities focuses our election work on nonpartisan efforts, so our real focus is making sure that Arab Americans are turning out to the polls regardless of who they vote for.
And how successful have you been? How engaged do you feel, Nadia, that the Arab American community is with the elections?
They're extremely engaged this year. The national network total for the entire country, we've been able to register nearly 5,000 voters. We're reaching out to about 30,000 voters for our GOTV efforts. Here in Michigan, we've been at high schools, we've been at colleges, we've been at community events, not only registering new voters, but turning people out to the polls. We've recruited close to 30 poll workers to actually work at the polls the day of the election, and they're all bilingual so that they can help Arabic speakers.
Daoud, can I get your thoughts on engagement of Muslim Americans with the whole election process and the races, both national and local?
I'll tell you from our office also is a organization. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we don't endorse candidates. However, we do make a legislative report card of the state reps, state senators, and congressmen and senators.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people in our community. I would not say a large majority, but there's a significant population that's not really as enthusiastic about President Obama as the last election, though. From our numbers, it appears to be that the majority of Muslims will be voting for President Obama. But we're really encouraging people to go out and get involved, to pay close attention to the local elections and the races here that really, you know, at the end of the day, we believe are just as important as who is elected to be the president of these United States of America.
Can I ask why you feel that there has been a waning of enthusiasm for President Obama among Muslim voters?
Well, I would say that there's two issues that many Muslims have raised concerns about. First is that on many key issues relating to civil and human rights, we really haven't seen any progress or any movement from Bush-era policies. We've had an increasement of usage of informants and agent provocateurs in our mosque sent in by the FBI under the Obama administration. And this is really a sensitive matter here, especially since there was a local imam that was killed during an FBI raid. But also on the foreign relations front, there's also the increased use of drones, in which there is a significant percentage, in fact, the majority percentage of drones used in Muslim-majority countries are killing unarmed civilians, women and children, and these are issues of great concern to Muslims all over the United States of America, but in particular in the state of Michigan.
And Daoud, how would you contrast that with the way Muslim voters might feel about Governor Romney?
Well, from what I've been hearing, that no one has really been appreciating or feeling Mitt Romney's comments, and especially during the last debate where it seemed like he was trying to pigeonhole or use Muslims as a whipping board. Well, he used the term Islamists or Islamic radicals, but a lot of the policies that regarding civil rights pertaining to the Muslim community and to conflicts in the Muslim world, including talking about preemptive war and preemptive bombing of Iran, has really turned a lot of people off in the community pertaining to supporting Mitt Romney.
I want to ask both of you, do the concerns and interests of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, are they pretty much in sync or do they sometimes diverge? Nadia, why don't you start with that?
I think a lot of times they are pretty much in sync. I mean, from our polling within the Arab American community here locally, we found that they're particularly concerned with issues that many Michiganders and Americans are concerned with, things like jobs in the economy, education, health care. Then there's also a unique set of issues that are important to Arab Americans, things that Daoud just mentioned, so civil liberties, civil rights, racial profiling, immigration reform, and foreign policy are also all things that our community takes into consideration when casting their vote.
Daoud, any thoughts? Is it pretty much in sync?
Well, I think that there may be some slight differences regarding in the Muslim community with the Arab community that may pertain to issues relating to class, but I don't think that there's a sizable differences. You know, in the American Muslim community, and actually the largest percentage of Muslims are African Americans. That includes in the state of Michigan as well, you know, including the western part of the state, as well as Flint area, Saginaw, and Grand Rapids. But, you know, a lot of these issues of people's politics really goes down to, as Nadia mentioned before, the bread and butter issues that relates to, you know, economy and education. And sometimes, or and many times, people vote their interests, and those interests can differ based upon socioeconomic levels.
Ultimately, how much impact do both of you believe that Muslims and Arab Americans could have on the election next week, and how much will we see in terms of turnout and participation?
Well, I think in a couple of swing states in particular where the vote has the potential of being close, I think that the percentage of Muslims as well as Arab Americans in two states in particular, Florida and Virginia, could be enough to actually tip the scales to one candidate or the other. There's been some very aggressive get out the vote campaigns regarding the Arab community and the Muslim community and in those states, and especially in Florida, not just in the presidential elections, but even in some key races.
And Nadia, the view from the Arab American community?
I really agree with what Dawood said. I think that there is real potential for Arab Americans to swing the vote in certain key states like Florida and Virginia, as Dawood mentioned. And I think that we're going to be turning out to the polls. I mean, our community is active. They traditionally are very active in politics. And I know that our community has been doing a lot of work to make sure that folks are going to be turning out to the polls. So they're going to be making an impact all over the country, and it's a group to be watching.
Thanks to both of you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk weather, shall we? Everyone is. With Superstorm Sandy on everyone's minds all over the world, we got to thinking about weather closer to home. Here in Michigan, whether it's too much snow, not enough snow, strange hot weather in spring, our first reaction is usually to blame everything on global warming. We hear scientists warning us of impending changes in our climate, but exactly what that means is often unclear. At the Great Lakes Climate Symposium 2012, happening today, scientists are sharing their latest research on climate change here in the Great Lakes. David Bidwell is a research fellow at the University of Michigan. David, there seems to be a high level of scientific certainty that the climate has truly changed in major ways in recent decades. So how has this change been felt and seen here in the Great Lakes over the past, say, 30 years?
When you talk about climate change, generally there's two areas that you talk about. One is temperature and one is precipitation. And throughout the Great Lakes region, we have seen an increase of 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit increase in the past decades. And so what we have seen is, in particular, in the overnight lows in the winter, that they haven't been as low. So it hasn't been getting as cold overnight during the winter, which may sound like a good thing to some people, but certainly those kinds of differences in temperature have a can have a big effect on things on the ground.
And so the impact in terms of, let's say, first of all, fish and wildlife, what has that meant?
So what you see mostly in terms of fish and wildlife is that you see a shift in the patterns of where you find certain species, and you see things moving over time. I was one of my favorite examples of this is a graph that some colleagues at the Nature Conservancy have used on some things before that shows where they found roadkill for the Virginia possums and see those moving north over time where you you find that species. But you're starting to see shifts in forest types and those kinds of things. And certainly in the models for the future, there's a concern that these things will continue to change over time. And certainly in terms of precipitation patterns and temperature, you start to get these overall changes in terms of the ecosystems.
And what about quality of life just for those of us who live in Michigan?
So I think that's really the important point in talking about the impacts of climate change is, you know, you can talk about where it affects things that people think are important, and folks often go straight to the pocketbook when they think about that. And certainly there are issues with economy and health and biodiversity and all those sorts of things. But the real question is, what is it that's important to you? And I think that in the Great Lakes, there's a really strong sense of identity, of living in the Great Lakes region that revolves around water a lot and recreation, and outdoor natural resource-based recreation, hunting, fishing. The coasts are very important as well. I mean, we know that during the summer, on the weekends, people drift towards the coasts and towards cottages that are out there. And so one of the questions that we have to address in thinking about climate impacts is, what are the ways in which the lifestyle that we know and for many of us that we embrace, how are those lifestyles going to be affected into the future?
Which actually led me to the question, as I contemplated all of this, is there anything that we can really do to mitigate these uncertain aspects of our future? Or is it going to be like trying to turn the Titanic away from that iceberg? It would be impossible.
So in general, in climate change, when you talk about policy or studying it, folks tend to focus on two different areas. One is mitigation, and that's the side where people talk about how do you slow, reduce, or stop changes to the climate, and particularly human-induced changes to the climate. And that's where you see a lot of conversations about greenhouse gases and reducing emissions and those kinds of things. So that's one side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side is adaptation to the impacts of climate change. You know, all of the systems that we care about have a certain zone in which they can cope in terms of temperature and precipitation and how those things work over time. And the worry is, how much is climate change going to send in any given system, whether it's a natural system or a social system, how much is it going to send us outside of that coping zone? So if you think about one of the possible impacts of climate change in the Great Lakes area being more increased heat waves.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You look at, for instance, this past summer where we had a lot of extreme heat, and you say, well, it's really hard to attribute any single weather event to climate change overall, but what an event like this summer, like the heat this summer does, is it shows us where we're vulnerable to extreme heat. And so you start to think of, what are ways that we can work within those vulnerabilities? So if you have, you know, city areas where you have a lot of people who are vulnerable because they don't have air conditioning or they have health conditions now, you start to think about, how do you set up systems to be able to watch out for those people or have cooling centers, those types of things. Similarly, if you're in agriculture and you've been having problems with heat stress or very heavy storms in the spring, you start to think about, what are the varieties of plants or crops that I grow? The cherry industry in Michigan is thinking, wow, we've had a lot of really bad luck with weather recently.
Right.
What if this is going to be a more common occurrence in the future? What is it that we want to do in terms of the kinds of trees that we're growing, or maybe thinking about diversifying the kinds of fruit that we grow to protect ourselves a little bit from the financial risk over time? And so those are some of the questions that we're hoping to inform.
And looking ahead, what do you expect to see in the future, the climate, say, for our grandchildren in 30 years? Will they even know what a snowman is?
So here's where things get really difficult in terms of working with climate change. We have a high degree of confidence that things have changed and that things will continue to change. Being able to say exactly how things are going to be in the future gets a little trickier, because the effects aren't distributed completely evenly throughout the area. We can say the region is getting warmer. It's hard to say exactly in your backyard what that's going to mean. One of the big effects in the Great Lakes area is the lakes are freezing less often. So what does that mean in terms of precipitation, snow, those kinds of things? That's where the science is right now, is really trying to figure out how our day-to-day lives and how the day-to-day lives of the ecosystems around us are being affected by those changes that we see, like less ice cover on the Great Lakes. So being able to predict how things are going to be in the future becomes more difficult, and we're certainly trying to build those models and look at that. But it becomes even more important that we build resilient systems that are able to accommodate a wider range of possible futures.
Big challenges ahead, issues being explored at the Great Lakes Climate Symposium 2012. David, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you for spending the time to talk about this.
David Bidwell is with the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessments Center. It's at the University of Michigan's Graham Environmental Sustainability Institute. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow at 3:00.